It's Monday, February 22nd. How do you survive when the inside of your home isn't safe either? We start here. The problem is no longer the electrical grid, it's the water grid.
When we came around and we heard it like a
The number of people affected here actually dwarfs how many lost power. We will take you inside some of their homes. While some people were crushing on Andrew Cuomo, some were asking whether he was getting their loved ones sick.
At best, hid the numbers, and at worst, may have fudged them.
We'll walk you through the controversy surrounding thousands of New York nursing home patients. And another week, more attacks against Asian Americans.
In many ways, it's sort of like the Asian George Floyd video.
Which raises the question, how much does the race of the perpetrator matter? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey.
We do want to move now to the post-storm crisis in Texas and several other states.
The president just signing a major disaster declaration for parts of this state.
Dozens have died, millions were left without power and drinking water, and vaccine shipments have been delayed from coast to coast.
We're picking up this week with the same thing that dominated so much of last week, the massive cold weather storms that led to a huge energy crisis that led to more than 4 million Texans losing power. As of today, Texas Governor Greg Abbott says lights should be on for just about everyone. So, 4 million people, much happier, much safer, right? Well, no. In fact, those 4 million without power have given way to, at one point this weekend, more than 14 million without clean running water. And that crisis is still playing out right now, in fact, getting more dangerous the longer it drags out. ABC's Trevor Ault joins us now from Houston. Trevor, we saw this become an issue in several states as the power went out, but none so much as Texas. How bad is it there?
Well, it's still really bad, Brad. I think that a lot of people might get the idea that since the power has returned in much of Texas, that the problem is over. And in reality, a lot of people say it's almost worse. They say they would certainly prefer to lose power if it meant they got to keep clean water at their home.
So you're mainly here to get bottles of water?
Yes.
What's it been like the past few days?
It's been a real challenge because my family members from Katy, they don't have anything at all.
So we're done here at this station. Move up whenever you can.
We're seeing millions of people who are still having to hunt for bottled water. They're relying on distribution sites set up in their community that are handing out thousands of bottles at a time, if they can even get their hands on that at the distribution site.
You don't have any food either? You guys are all out of everything. Did you have to throw things away because of the lost power? Everything went bad?
And not to mention you have so many disenfranchised people in Texas who don't have the ability to go to these distribution sites. And that stretches from the ability to have clean drinking water, the ability to wash your pots and pans if you're going to be cooking at home.
I even thought about getting snow to bring it in to melt, to flush the potty. That was our next step.
Once we smelled the wood, we knew either one of the walls was leaking or it was just like a small leak. But when we came around and we heard it like a like it was just gushing, that's when we noticed that was down.
All up here.
And that's all compounded by the fact that because of the insane freeze that Texas just endured, we're seeing tons of homes that have been ruined by pipes bursting.
By the time I went upstairs, found the valves, the whole ceiling just collapsed on top of all of our personal items in the living room and dining room.
Because so much of Texas was never built to endure the temperatures that we saw last week.
And I was going to say, Trevor, we spoke to someone last week. He had lost his running water because he had lost his electricity. So I would assume that electricity comes on, therefore water comes on, everything should be okay. Why is that not the case?
Did I hear correctly you've been sleeping on a cot at the emergency?
Yeah, not the best accommodations, but hey.
Well, what we're hearing from officials, specifically I talked to the mayor of Houston, and it's a complicated process, number one, to get the water flowing entirely, and number two, to get that water approved once it has fallen off.
Once you get up, for example, with the right pressure.
And at least one of these issues that's led to the boil water advisory that millions of people are under is the fact that the power goes out at the water treatment plants. So they shut down. Now the water is no longer safe to drink.
You get the water pressure up to 35 PSI.
and then they want you to hold there for 12 hours to make sure that it's not going to drop again.
It's not as simple as simply flipping the switch back on at the water treatment plant and then everyone can drink their water. Now you have to go through a lengthy process of making sure it's working, getting your testing samples, sending it off to the lab, because they're not going to blindly trust that the water is safe.
They have to lay out for 24 hours to see whether or not there's any bacteria that grows there.
Without that approval, the city cannot tell you your water is safe. And so we get stuck in this holding pattern where city leaders and state leaders can't even tell a lot of these people when they're going to have their water back.
Because the boil water notice has now been lifted.
Make no mistake, Brad, we are seeing some progress. Yesterday afternoon, Houston finally lifted its boil water advisory, and that was on the earlier end of the spectrum that the mayor told me on when the water could return. That's a great sign. Still, millions of people have not gotten that news just yet, so we still have all those people waiting for water.
All right, we're moving on from the Texas power outage to the Texas power outrage.
And also, even though much of the power is restored, Brad, many people who were fortunate to never lose their power are not out of the woods.
Wholesale prices for electricity in Texas got really nuts over the past several days. At one point, 1 megawatt went from $50 to about $9,000.
They're getting sky-high electric bills that you would not believe. We talked to one guy who got a $17,000 electric bill, and people who...
Why would you get an electric bill for that much? I'm sure you're using a little more heat, but you're not using that much more heat. Like, what?
Well, essentially, many people in Texas are on variable rates for their power. And in general, you could save a lot of money on your electric bill that way, but... if you think about it like trying to score an Uber on New Year's Eve, everybody is trying to use their power, use their heat during this historic storm that we saw. And so the variable rate of power for some people went up 50 times higher than it had ever been before.
Hi, Jade. How are you?
Funny news.
And so I talked to one mother, Brad, who knew the rate was going up astronomically high. So they turned off everything that they could think of in their home.
I mean, I literally took my fridge off. I took everything off the power and just had my thermostat running.
They unplugged their refrigerator. They filled it with snow to keep it cold. They didn't want their pipes to burst, so they wrapped their pipes in diapers. They literally only had their thermostat going. And for 4 days... their bill was $621.
I just felt very frustrated because when I knew our power was back and they said, please go to another provider, they urged us. And I was on the phone call for 3 days with many different providers and they could only switch me on the 23rd.
Which we're not even there. We're not even two yet.
No.
And... making it even worse is that while the state says they're going to try to address this, they don't want any of these people to be on the hook for the bill, the way these electrical companies are set up is that often that money is automatically deducted from your account. So even though you might eventually maybe get some federal funds to pay you back for those astronomical bills, there's a chance that you just got several thousand dollars automatically deducted from your account to pay your power bill to keep warm, because the alternative was that you let your house fall to 32 degrees.
Wow. And the governor now says electricity providers will not be cutting power to anyone who doesn't pay. They might even issue a moratorium on invoices going forward so they can figure out those insane bills. But like you said, like many have perhaps already been deducted. Trevor, watching this, can I just say, is like watching a developing country or something. And when I think about a developing country, for every person who is out there making noise, complaining, there's another person who probably can't complain because like they're in even worse shape. So they don't even have the resources to get out there and make noise. Are we getting the sense of the scope of just how damaging and dangerous this has been?
This was the first house that they got my papa and my big mama.
Right. Yeah.
I think that we're only just now starting to get a sense of how big of a scope this is, Brad, because every person that we talk to says, number one, this has been really rough for me.
I'm not supposed to be crying on camera.
It's all right.
But it's still hard now that he's gone, because it's like, when we go through things, my papa knew how to fix it. He knew what to do. Like, so it's kind of hard. And like, now dealing with the house that we really can't afford to really get it fixed, it's, you know, it's...
But number two, I consider myself lucky because so many people have had it worse. You have to remember, there have been dozens of people who have reportedly died from hypothermia in one of the hottest regions of the entire country, and those dozens of cases are only the ones that we know about so far. The list is growing every day.
All right, Trevor Ault there in Houston. Thanks so much, Trevor.
Thanks, Brad.
Possibly as soon as today, we'll learn that this country has now lost 500,000 people to COVID-19.
We never thought this would happen to our family, and it did.
They took her to the hospital, and next thing you know, Tuesday morning, she's gone.
The numbers have gotten remarkably better in recent weeks. The death and case rates have dropped. The number of Americans in the hospital from COVID has been cut in half in just 6 weeks. But when you hear a number like 500,000, you wonder just how many of those deaths could have been avoided if leaders had listened to the science.
At the end of the day, science trumps politics.
In the early days of the pandemic, one of the governors credited with walking in lockstep with healthcare policy experts was the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo. His briefings were seen as the antidote to all the confusion in Washington. Cuomo basically became a meme unto himself.
We went up the mountain, we went down the mountain. We have the beast on the run, there's no doubt about that. Wearing a mask is now cool. I believe it's cool.
But as we approach this ever more terrible death toll, Cuomo himself is facing questions over how many people may have died in nursing homes who didn't have to. ABC senior investigative reporter Aaron Katursky is here. Aaron, can you walk me through what's happened here? Because criticism has really gained momentum here since earlier this month.
Gaining momentum earlier this month, Brad, but this is a controversy that's been simmering for months because of the unusually large number of COVID-19 deaths in New York nursing homes, by our count now upwards of 15,000.
It was supposed to be temporary, and they failed us.
There was a freezer to store the dead right next door.
But the numbers have been a matter of debate.
It seems that what y'all are doing is just trying to minimize. And nobody says that you went into these nursing homes and threw people off a flight of stairs.
Back in June, the state legislature had asked the governor for the real numbers. They wanted to know how many COVID-19 deaths had occurred among nursing home residents.
If we want to get clear information, we need to get clear information so that we can make better policy.
And the governor ended up putting them off and sort of stonewalling the request. And his excuse, as we've learned now in the last couple of weeks from his top aide, Melissa DeRosa, has been that everything was happening at once. The Justice Department had started poking around.
DeRosa says, and basically we froze because then we were in a position where we weren't sure if what we were going to give the Department of Justice or what we give you guys, what we start saying, was going to be used against us.
And the governor's aide said that had the governor's office actually given the state legislature the numbers they had asked for, the fear was they would have been used against the governor by former President Trump.
She says he starts tweeting that we killed everyone in nursing homes.
At the time, he had been pressing a theory that the governor's policies had led to an increase in nursing home deaths at the height of the pandemic.
A governor who's done a truly poor, thousands, tens of thousands of people have died in his state, Andrew Cuomo.
Well, yeah, and I think that's kind of a central question here, Aaron. Like, is there a difference between withholding data? Because withholding data is bad because, you know, that affects how we treat future cases. But there's a difference between withholding data and being accused of causing more deaths with, like, dangerous policies. Which one of those is Cuomo being questioned about?
Now they're questioning both. And a lot of this, Brad, may be the fault of Governor Cuomo himself and his combative personality.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo saying the president is enabling the pandemic.
What he's really saying is, if we didn't test, we wouldn't find the cases. Mr. President, don't be a co-conspirator of COVID.
He had been given high marks for how he handled this, writing a book about his leadership style in the middle of all of this. And that really rubbed people the wrong way, including former President Trump.
He put them back in, infected people back in with our elderly population, knowing that our elderly population is susceptible. Andrew Cuomo, he killed thousands and thousands of people.
And pushed out this idea that Cuomo had directed nursing home residents who were still recuperating from coronavirus to be sent back into the nursing homes before they were fully healed and before they actually tested negative. And at the time, it really did make critics wonder whether that policy fueled the number of deaths among nursing home patients due to COVID-19.
Well, yeah, because you think, like, that would sound bad, I would think, if somebody told me, hey, yeah, we had this patient who just had coronavirus. They hadn't really cleared yet, and we just sent them back in to live with your very healthy grandmother when she's super at risk. Like, that would not sound great.
Except, Brad, it seems like, and Cuomo has said this repeatedly, COVID-19 was already in the nursing homes.
Yes, we had more people die in nursing homes than anywhere else because we had more people die. Because the federal government missed the boat and never told us that this virus was coming from Europe and not from China.
Staff members had brought it in from the outside, and that's, it's believed, how the nursing homes became so infected with the virus. The other thing is that at the time, if you think about it, when this directive was issued back in March, there was a real concern about available hospital space.
New York, the epicenter in the U.S., still in need of more space and more supplies.
Governor Cuomo warning of a major deficit in ICU beds.
And they just did not have the capacity to do the kind of recuperative care that they may have wanted to. So these nursing home residents had to go somewhere, and the nursing homes were their homes. But it doesn't stop the families of these people from wondering whether their loved ones had to die from this. And it's been a nagging question.
Vivian Zayas says the new nursing home numbers do not surprise her. Her mother, Anna Martinez, is one of thousands of New Yorkers who contracted the coronavirus while in a nursing home and later died.
Our seniors deserve justice.
And rather than explain it all, the governor's office ended up stonewalling the state legislature, effectively the public.
We created a void by not producing enough public information fast enough.
And at best, hid the numbers, and at worst, may have fudged them. The New York Attorney General did an investigation, and last month she concluded that the state may have undercounted the number of deaths in nursing homes during the pandemic by as much as 50%.
Wow. Okay, so then what happens next, whether it's for Cuomo himself, his reputation, or, you know, just for the state? We're still seeing people dying here.
Well, sure, Brad, and thankfully the numbers are coming down. Cuomo remains relatively popular. The state legislature has been considering ways to strip him of some of the emergency powers that have allowed him to make the decisions he has during the pandemic.
I think the leaderships on both houses are discussing what could be done to make sure that we have an equal branch of the government moving forward.
The problem for the state legislature is what happens the next day. And this is where the lawmakers can't agree. If they suddenly strip Cuomo of his emergency power, does that mean restaurants can just open back up? Does that mean no one has to quarantine upon entry into the state? They're trying to figure out a mechanism for keeping in place some of the more successful decisions while also making it clear that they think it's time to reassert the legislative branch in New York.
Right. And that tension is actually something we're seeing in several states at this point. Just how much power, who has the authority, whether it's restrictions or vaccinations, and whether that's the city, the state, or the feds. Aaron Kuchersky, thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, another assault in the street again against an Asian American. We're back in a bit. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, Visit Hyatt.com/start here.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've told you about the sharp rise in violent attacks recently against Asian Americans. Well, since then, we have witnessed more.
The guy just peeked out of the coffee shop and he goes, "I'll F you up." And then all of a sudden, he comes out and tosses like a box of spoons at her.
On Friday, police arrested a man for attacking a woman in Queens, New York. Apparently, this 52-year-old woman asked a guy a question about the line in front of a bakery. He started throwing things at her and then shoved her into a newspaper rack so hard that she passed out and needed to get stitches. The woman happened to be a family friend of the actress Olivia Munn. Her post about it went viral. But this is just one of many attacks. And when we talk about hate crimes in this country, the majority of them are committed by white people. The most common victims are African American and Jewish people. But do authorities respond differently when it's not in that same mold? And does it complicate how we think about these crimes? I want to turn to ABC's Juju Chang, the co-anchor of Nightline, because Juju, when we were seeing these videos, particularly in the Bay Area, you could see lots of media, even a lot of authorities, just struggling with the question of how to address race, because several of these attacks on Asian Americans were committed by black perpetrators. I think the suspect in Queens appeared to be Latino or maybe a white guy. And you've been examining whether that's relevant, but even more importantly, how hate crimes and racial violence are addressed in situations like this.
Absolutely. And I think what these videos trigger is some of the longstanding tensions between the African-American community and the Asian community. And that is the double-edged sword of all of this attention, right? Because we see a few surveillance videos that then become almost viral.
In Oakland, disturbing attacks on the elderly.
This 71-year-old grandmother pushed to the ground.
This horrifying video of a 91-year-old man being pushed to the pavement.
They get played over and over and over again because Hollywood celebrities like Daniel Day Kim are coming forward.
The way we see it is that it's not one community against another. It's everyone versus racism.
In many ways, it's sort of like the Asian George Floyd video. It's so compelling when you see somebody's life senselessly taken away. But like in a lot of situations, when you dig deeper, there's much more complexity.
There was also an arrest in the brutal attack that's so hard to watch. An 84-year-old man from Thailand, Visha Ratanapakti, tackled hard, his head hitting the pavement last Thursday morning as he was out for a walk. He later died.
So, for example, one of the 19-year-old suspects who was arrested for the murder of an 84-year-old Asian man, his lawyer said, you know, his client had no knowledge of the race of the victim because he was wearing a hat and his face was covered, that he's biracial himself and has Asians in his family, and that this was not a bias crime, and that, in fact, it was the mental break of a teenager.
She did get, like, really bad bruises.
In one case, a 70-year-old grandmother was pushed to the ground and beaten.
Oakland police say the suspect in that case also attacked a 60-year-old man and a 55-year-old woman that same day.
Three other incidents in the Bay Area, which account for this sort of what's seen as this rash of attacks on older Asian Americans, that young man has a history of mental illness as well and has spent time subsequently in the psych ward. So we have to look deeper and broader. And when I interviewed Daniel Day Kim, he said, look, we can talk about the nuances of each and every case, but what we need to get at is why is it that even in these disturbed, perhaps, psyches, that it's okay to attack someone that vulnerable?
It is not just a Black and Asian issue. It is something in the psyche of this country where somehow it's okay to abuse, physically or verbally abuse Asian Americans.
I was going to say, like, even if race was irrelevant in a certain case or something, being Asian American, like that's not ancillary to so many of these crimes that we've seen because it's such a clear uptick over the last year.
Absolutely. And what advocates have shown by tallying the crimes, that there were thousands of incidents that directly spiked after the former president started using phrases like Wuhan flu and Kung flu.
It's not racist at all. No, not at all. It comes from China.
And there has, as I said, been this sense that Asians are other, right? That they're not fully American. And so it's easy to tap into that. But it's classic scapegoating. The man who was shoved and killed, he's Thai. You know, half of the Asian Americans who were hurt on the street in these hate attacks, they're not even Chinese. They've never even been to China. They're Americans who've been born here. And that's the message that I spoke to Congresswoman Grace Meng.
There are always instances where we are made to feel that we are foreigners.
I'm calling about the Karate Kid virus.
Hey, you look like a Chinese virus, you fat slob.
I started to get voicemails through our office voicemail box, you know, criticizing me, saying that, of course, the virus came from China.
And she literally, I was so surprised, got emotional, started crying because she said, I've been calling out for a year into the wilderness, asking people to pay attention to these hate crimes.
You know, please, somebody pay attention. Please, you know, notice us. Give me confirmation that, you know, I am American too. And I just haven't been able to feel that in a long time.
And then she went on to tell me about the talk.
What's the talk?
The talk that she was having with her two young sons.
I said, look, you know, this is what's going on. There are people in this country who will take a look at you and without knowing anything about you, may call you something that is derogatory, may even try to cause harm to you.
And I said to her at the time, like, it sounds like the talk that African Americans have with their young children.
It's interesting, I think, that you mentioned the talk, Juju, because I do think there's like a specific stereotype that Asian Americans have been contending with for years. Like that, you've called it before, the model minority myth and all the talk about how well Asian American families are doing. And yet it obscures the very violent, very antagonistic type of racism that Asian Americans are also familiar with.
Absolutely. And, you know, the model minority myth, and it is that it's a myth because, you know, often the success of Crazy Rich Asians and Bling Empire makes it seem like Asians are all prosperous, but they're not. Poverty levels for Asian Americans in urban settings is as high as African Americans. And so they were rendered invisible. And so that is a way in which Asian Americans have been pitted against other minority groups to say, why can't you be like the Asians? But the truth is, that is a fallacy.
There was a man out here who says, we're all trained to shoot. Why? What's the feeling?
Well, see, we have no hatred towards black people. We have nothing against anybody. All we wanted to do is work hard and make it like the rest of us.
You know, we point back to the unrest after the Rodney King verdicts. You know, it was Korean shop owners against African-Americans.
People are driving by shooting at us, and we have to do something about it. We have no police support whatsoever.
So there is this history of tension that these groups have been working for.
The pain of the Asian community has been muted for decades.
We followed a young activist by the name of Will Lex Ham.
We're sick and tired of being invisible and ignored in our country.
And part of his inspiration, ironically, is the protests following George Floyd's murder.
We are the voice of the voiceless.
We are the voice of the voiceless.
We will not go away.
It is a racial awakening for Asian Americans as well. And when I talked to Daniel Day Kim, he said, I was out on the streets protesting and saw so many Asian Americans out there too protesting for black lives.
Historically, there have been tensions between the African American and Asian American communities. George Floyd galvanized the two communities in a way that I'd never seen before.
And that this is the time for us to unite as people of color, as people who have been seen as other or, you know, had racial injustice visited upon us, to find our new political voice and now call for full racial healing.
All right, Juju Chang, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Brad. Anytime.
Golden Globe goes to Jennifer Lawrence, Silver Lining Playbook.
And one last thing, because hardly anyone went to the movies last year, no movie is going to be able to boast about its box office performance. However, they can, starting soon, brag about awards.
Oh, what does it say? I beat Meryl.
We're now less than a week away from the first big one of the year, the Golden Globes. But wouldn't you know, yesterday, the Los Angeles Times unveiled sweeping reporting questioning just how professional Golden Globe voters are. Hey, Jason, can I just tell you my impression of the Golden Globes, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but, like, I've always thought Golden Globes are like the Oscars predictor, right? So if someone wins Best Drama at the Golden Globes and then it gets that Oscar nomination, I'm like, well, I'm going to see that, because that is perhaps going to be the thing that wins Best Picture. What is the reputation of the Golden Globes within Hollywood?
This is what makes my job so tough sometimes, is that perception is totally wrong.
That's Jason Nathanson, ABC's Hollywood correspondent.
The Golden Globe nominations don't matter. They don't mean anything. Don't put any weight or stock into what they are in terms of predictors for the Golden Globes and the other award nominations.
Really?
And also in terms of the significance or the importance of them.
That award is, no offense, worthless. It's a bit of metal that some nice old confused journalists wanted to give you in person so they could meet you and have a selfie with you.
Because at the end of the day, what they are awards given out by 90 members of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which is a group that has had a lot of trouble when it comes to legitimacy and credibility. They've worked to fix that over the years, but we don't know. They don't publish a list of their members, so we don't know who they are.
They don't say who their members are?
No, they don't.
And he says for years, the Hollywood Foreign Press has been trying to shake this image of reclusive, tuxedo-wearing club members who can get themselves paid handsomely for their quote-unquote work.
Then it was seen that they kind of cleaned up their act a bit and became a lot more legitimate. They were a foundation. They were given money to social causes and charities and things like that.
Jason says a lot of this stems from a lawsuit last year from a Norwegian journalist who covers entertainment. She wanted to join the Hollywood Foreign Press Association and was denied.
She filed a lawsuit alleging a culture of corruption, saying that this tax-exempt organization operated kind of like a cartel, says the LA Times. They kind of blackballed you from being able to get interviews with a lot of the studios.
In the meantime, keeping your membership number so low means each member becomes that much more valuable, which can become really apparent when you notice how much access certain journalists get.
If you want to win an Oscar and if you're a studio, you have to campaign. Well, for the Oscars, there are about 8,500 to 9,000 voters that you have to kind of sway. And, you know, you're doing it like a politician. You're doing meet and greets and things like that. For the Golden Globes, it's about 90 people. So it's a lot easier to sway 90 people than it is
like
to sway 9,000
stuff. But like the studio, they can spring for 90 really fancy dinners. Like they can accommodate that.
So one of the allegations in this, and we see this all the time, because again, when the Golden Globe nominations come out, there's always a couple really wacky things.
You guys just kiss so much here.
He gave an example. Emily in Paris on Netflix is considered fine, fun to watch, but it's not a critic's favorite.
Oh, and you dropped your crepe. Hashtag old crepe.
Well, the LA Times reports that a couple years ago, the Paramount studio flew all the Golden Globes voters out to the set in Paris. All of them. Everyone gets hotels, meals, wine, everything comped. Emily in Paris then gets multiple Golden Globe nominations, while other, more acclaimed shows were shut out completely.
Wait, so Jason, if they're just reporting this whole thing is for some old people to get extra swag? Like, what does everyone in Hollywood do? Like, does everyone still participate in the big show on Sunday?
All just goes on as normal. The only thing that's going to change maybe are some of the jokes for hosts Tina Fey and Amy Poehler.
A key part of the story is that some members think their own group has lost legitimacy, and they were hoping this lawsuit would have changed things. Well, the journalist lawsuit was dismissed. She's refiling. In the meantime, Emily in Paris has now been nominated for two of the year's biggest awards. Juicy stuff going on in Hollywood this year. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.